Okay, so now we're starting to move into the 80s, the mid-80s, so this is my period. And on a personal note, it's an incredible experience for me to read some of the Sichot that I haven't read, because they weren't published before, they were deeply embedded in some file in the VBM. And I'd forgotten that I'd heard these Sichot. But I've been speaking a lot, obviously, over my career about these issues. And I said, oh, that's where I got it from. It's so affirming and interesting for me to see how deeply these Sichot etched my own Zionist consciousness and my own redemptive perspectives and attitudes. So I've said that so many times. Now I remember hearing that Sichot in 1984 and 1985 and how deeply it shaped my identity, my Zionist identity, religious identity. So in one of his Sichot in the mid-80s, and this is where Avamital is starting to develop a slightly different voice than much of the religious Zionist camp. Let's say in the 70s, he becomes one of the leading voices in the aftermath of the 73 war, and in particular because he was the founder of the modern Hasdur movement, and people looked to him for guidance, and unfortunately the yeshiva lost 8 of its Talmidim, so that gave him a bama and a microphone to help people recover from the war. Now it's the mid-80s, and all of a sudden, the whole Zionist, religious Zionist world, because it's so committed to settlements, and because settling the land is always never legal, or it doesn't go through classic due process, but you settle, and the government says no, and then you push a little harder, and then the government says yes, and it's always turning a blind eye. So it creates, and unfortunately we see 30, 40 years later, it creates almost an adversarial sometimes relationship between government agencies and police force and army and rule of law and settler enterprise, and sometimes it flares up in violence. And the settling of the land doesn't mean you're walking to the UN, signing people up with a document and putting down your house. Unfortunately, it's a different type of a process. And what is happening is, in the religious Zionist camp, this behavior that's becoming a little bit, Rav Amital feels, lawless and anarchy-driven. And Rav Amital starts to speak about self-critiquing. You hear a lot of his intellectual honesty and intellectual integrity, and you see that. Sometimes people ask, what is intellectual integrity? Well, sometimes you read someone writes an article and they'll state their ideas, what they represent, their institution, their ideas, their religion, their perspective. That's how the article ends. More often, or when you read people of intellectual integrity, they'll both assert their values but also critique themselves. And where can the values become a little bit more dangerous? And where does the religion go wrong? And of course, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein was famous for that. They'd ask him, they'd invite him to a modern Orthodox convention to assess the state of modern Orthodoxy or to assess modern Orthodoxy versus Haredim. And he'd spend maybe 2 minutes assessing Haredim, highlighting their strong points, and then an hour of a confessional about all the problems and ills of modern Orthodox faces. You see that a lot in Novi Sachs, by the way, how he's a great defender of religion, but he critiques religion when he feels it. So that it's important to have humility, not to say it in ways that are very aggressive and dismissive, and people are very sarcastic about their own institutions, but in a way that just, you can see, I have an eye enough in my day, in my age already, I can pick out not just religious people, I can pick out columnists for newspapers who write with intellectual honesty and humility. They're a little bit different, and those that don't, I try to read those who have intellectual humility, write without this pompous air of self-righteousness and self-assuredness. So Rav Amital is starting to critique some of the dangers of what I call RZ, right? RZ. People say RZ is religious Zionism. Rav Amital is trying to make us not to religious Zionists, but also to responsible Zionists, because he felt that some of the Zionism and the messianism and the redemptive fervor and fever was creating certain dangers. And I made a list of 5 of them that he speaks about in one of his Sichot, or actually a combination of several Sichot. First of all, the self-assuredness, right? We know this all ends. How does this all end? It's obvious. When Yerushalayim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu redeems us, the nations gather. When Iran huffs and puffs and blows smoke, I'm not intimidated by it, because I know it's just a house of cards. We've been there before. I'd go down to the bank and take out a mortgage and bank on the Jewish fortune. I'd remortgage my house and bet on the Jewish future, because it's built into history. The Jewish people will remain in their land. There won't be a third Khurban. That can lead to reckless decision-making. Well, if we're assured, then we have to start thinking rationally. We have to start thinking morally. You know how this will end. And Rav Amital told us, I'm using my words now, but Rav Amital taught me this, we know how this will end, but not when it will end and how the journey will be to get to that end. So we all know that we will end up in Eretz Yisrael with our Beis HaMikdash, but it's 20 years, it's 200 years. We all know that we'll end up in Eretz Yisrael, Yerushalayim, but will there be wars that exact casualties and suffering? We all know, but that doesn't give you the right to abdicate or to abandon moral considerations, halacha considerations, practical considerations. So just to highlight, Chas Hashem, not to even say these words, but just to highlight to you, some people are always saying, fanatics, extremists, radical people, radical thinkers, but let's blow up the Temple Mount. Why? Oh yeah, 200 million Arabs will probably invade Israel tomorrow, but that will force Hashem's hand, because Hashem has to defend us. And why can't we accelerate Mashiach by pouring some jet fuel in the fire? Chas Hashem, aside from the moral implications, just you can lead to terrible, terrible loss of life, aside from the moral implications of attacking somebody you don't know it. So Rav Amital was trying to encourage us to just act responsibly, act based on the same systems of morality and ethics and ration and halacha that governed us in the past. Number two, because it's always in the settler world became the religious Zionist world to the center, so there was a sense of, well, I can make decisions even though the government doesn't support those decisions. So that whole question of personal autonomy versus respecting institutions and respecting law and respecting the vote of the Knesset, and well, I don't care where the Knesset voted, and I don't care. We have the right, again, because this is messianic, I'm operating at a different level. I'm an agent of Mashiach, so right, some of the greatest crimes in human history, not just in the Jewish world, have been committed based on utopian fantasies. Right? Marx was a utopianist, communism to a degree. Every end is the end of a utopian society, justifies bloodshed, justifies totalitarian regimes, justifies suppressing human freedom. So whenever you feel like there's an endpoint that hovers above history and above human experience, so you can violate the laws of human society and of human government and violate human parameters because you're aiming for something larger, the redemption of history. So millenarius politics and millenarius vision. So be all personal autonomy versus respecting government and respecting the agencies of government. Relatedly to that, Rav Amital was shocked by not just the political decision or the social decision, but the moral, it's just arrogance. You know better, and I know better than everyone. And it breeds an arrogance that not only do I not have to respect the government, but I know what's right. Sometimes the messiness is just so cocksure and confident and self-assured that I know exactly what it is. So because you're operating, again, you feel you know some messianic code that other people don't. So it's not just that you're willing to violate. And again, he's writing this. He's telling us this about 10 years before Yigal Amir. And then 10 years later, this all blows up in our face, and you're seeing, it's almost prophetic, where I know better, and therefore I'm going to act irresponsibly, and I'm going to murder someone, and I'm going to disrespect the symbols of government and the agencies of government, and of course, shed human life. So arrogance, personal autonomy versus government authority, self-assuredness, and reckless and irresponsible behavior. Then you talk about something else, lack of awareness, where there was a lot of xenophobic statements being made because, again, we want to settle the land. There's only one problem. There are other people on this land that have historical rights or whatever, legal rights, whatever. I can get into the politics, but they live here right now. So the easiest way to just create a simplistic view of our settlement is to just denounce the value or the humanity of the people around us, and it leads to a lot of bigotry, and even in today's day, unfortunately. So I think one of the great legacies of this yeshiva is that it is the leading settlement yeshiva, and it's created the leading settlement block. But I hope that our Talmidim and the people in this area in general are the types of people that respect the rights of others and show dignity and kindness and compassion to others. And that's not an easy blend to pull off. It's not an easy juggling act. But there were people who were talking about, in very public fashion, yeah, goyim, you can kill them, you can murder them, you can... I remember I was horrified. There was a panel conversation in the mid-80s, very, very hyped up panel conversation between Rav Aaron and Rav Dov Lior, who's a very, very, very well-known, well-respected Talmud Chacham, the Rav Roshi of Chevron, I don't know the exact title, he's still alive today, and had a panel conversation, and supposedly, if my memory serves me correctly, Rav Lior said, it's better that X amount of Palestinians be killed rather than the fingernail of a Jewish chayal be damaged. Like basically, we should that is the yardstick we should apply towards our policies in the Shtachim. That we can't allow any danger to face our Chayalim, even if the cost for that policy would be masses and masses of Palestinian deaths. And this is horrifying. It's a horrific concept. you just take human life so carelessly and callously. Human beings that have Tzelem Elokim. Rav Avraham wrote a famous article in one of the newspapers about the Tzelem Elokim. So they were coming out with statements. Rav Avital didn't discuss it philosophically. He just thought, again, he was much more sensitive to his part in history, saying, how could you say these statements that will be Mechal Hashem Shemayim and will make our neighbors, not just our Arab neighbors, but the international community, not offended, but just righteously, justifiably. Throughout history, I remember the statement, throughout history, we lived in foreign countries and our Chachamim were so careful and judicious about what to say and when to say, knowing that they were living far. And all of a sudden, you're in Eretz Yisrael and you say whatever you like. And you blow your mouth off with all these types of irresponsible statements, not just that are immoral, but are also very dangerous, incendiary, that could light a powder keg. And the final statement he said, which again seared my consciousness very deeply, said, and it's also going to endanger Jews in the Chutzlarts. If the Jewish state is talking about killing, it's going to lead to anti-Semitism, it's going to lead to caricatures of Jewish bigotry. And he said, Eretz Yisrael, he said this very powerfully, belongs not just to the citizens in Israel, Eretz Yisrael belongs to every single Jew. And therefore, the statements and policies we adopt in this country have to take into account Jews in Mexico and Jews in, which is a very revolutionary statement. A lot of people, what do you mean? You don't live in Israel. You don't have the right to vote. And Rav Avital convinced me that no, this is a heritage country. And it's a heritage country, belongs to every Jew. Now, it may be that if you live outside, when people in Chutz La'aretz mouth off about politics here in Israel, people get very, very angry here in Israel. I'm thrilled. Because mouthing off means that it's part of you. I don't mouth off about Bolivia. I couldn't care less about Bolivia, but it's not my heritage country. But if I'm living in New York, if I'm living in Washington, this is my country. I have the right. Now, could be you should be a little bit more careful and discreet about entering and voicing political opinions if you don't understand the subtleties and sophistications and complexities of life in Israel. In Washington, everything seems black and white, right? Just settle all the land. And when you live in Israel, you realize life is a little more complex, like with anything. Just like I don't issue my opinions about American policy. I don't live there. I don't understand the nuances. So from a distance, all these subtleties get blurred. You don't see the resolution. You don't have magnification. When people say there's a big problem, there's a big demographic problem. No one can afford an apartment in Yerushalayim. Why can't younger couples afford apartments? Because all the rich people across the world buy up all the apartments of rich Jews in Yerushalayim. It's absentee ownership. They come once or twice a year, but it drives up the already high skyrocketing real estate prices. So a lot of young couples in Israel that want to live in Yerushalayim are justifiably offended by it, and I understand that. I'm thrilled. I'm thrilled that Yerushalayim has become an international city, that people want to have an apartment that they'll live in once or twice a year because it gives them a toehold in Eretz Yisrael. But it changed our orientation. And in a lot of the religious Zionist ranks, these ideas were not being voiced. And this is not just, a lot of people say, what was Rav Avital's break with the classic Talmidim of Habakkuk? And they talk about the Sabra and Shatila massacres in 82, and it became much more dovish where they became hawkish. That was part of it, but it was much more. There's a whole orientation of how to define Zionism. He re-articulated religious Zionism by grounding it, making it more responsible, less arrogant, less self-autonomous, and more sensitive to the organic Jewish world rather than what's happening in the settlement on that hilltop. So I'll try to uncover some of these things in the next day or two. But it's really fascinating. I heard these sichot and how deeply it shaped me. Oh, that's where I got it from. I've been saying these things for Rav Avital said what I said. It was mechavit to what I said. Okay. Have a good day, everyone. Yeah.